Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 47, recorded April 4th, 2012. Jeff Clavier. Triangulation is brought to you by Stamps.com. Time is money, so don't waste another minute waiting in line at the post office. Just use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, using your own computer and printer. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com now. Click on the radio microphone and enter Triangulation. At Stamps.com, Triangulation. And by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, helping you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Learn more about the technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at Ford.com/technology. And by Vast Conference, the ultimate in professionalism, clarity, and flexibility for your conference calls, all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to VastConference.com and use the offer code Triangulation. It's time for Triangulation. Welcome once again to the show where we take somebody of great interest, a brilliant, smart, big thinker, and pelt them with tough, probing questions or softballs. Just depends on the mood. Tom Merritt is here, as always, to help me become the third leg to Jeff Clavier, our subject today on Triangulation. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, everyone. Hey, guys. How you doing?
Jeff is is it fair to call you a venture capitalist?
Yes.
Not an angel?
I used to be an angel, and I lost my wings when I stopped investing my own money and started investing somebody else's.
So that's the difference. The difference is an angel's investing his own money or her own money, and a VC has a fund that you've raised with investors, and then they trust you as managing partner of SoftTech to take their money and put it in something that's going to make money.
Yes.
But you were nominated as one of the best angels. Why change from angel to venture? What's the advantage there?
Two things. One is scale. So obviously when you're an angel, you're going to be investing your own money in chunks of 25, 50, 100K. And there is just so much you can do in terms of numbers of deals and the amounts you're going to be investing. When you invest as a fund, you can take 5 to 10% of a company, invest half a million up to $1 million, and really sort of work hard with the company to have it become something interesting that traditional VCs will want to invest in. That's one aspect. The other is it's actually kind of interesting for an outsider like me, you know, the French non-Stanford, non-Harvard guy, to actually build a new kind of VC firm under the nose of the VCs in the Valley. And I thought that was actually pretty cool to do.
You call yourself a micro VC. So it's what is that?
So back in 2004, when we started to invest as angel investors in Web 2.0, people sort of called that small group of people who were doing a bunch of investments super angels. And so in 2006, I was one of the, maybe 10 super angels. And then when we raised our funds, so SoftTech VC2, our first institutional fund of 15 million, was one of the first way back when, and people had to call that something. And so people said, well, it's a super angel fund, but by definition, you can't be a super angel fund if you raise money from other people.
Right.
And someone said, let's call them micro VCs, which, to be candid, is actually a pretty good definition of what we do. We're VCs just with smaller funds.
But the investments include Mint, which Intuit acquired, Truvio, AOL, Ustream, which we're on right now, Bleco, Eventbrite, Tapulous, Disney acquired it. You've got some pretty good startups to your roster. What was your first investment? Do you remember when that was?
Sure. My very first investment was Feedster.
Oh,
remember?
Yeah. Feedster.
Which was, a search engine for blogs and RSS feeds. And it ended up being sort of a total failure. And I lost $40,000 my entire investment in that deal. But that was the best marketing investment I've ever made because it got me into the community of investors who are now my friends and peers. And, you know, that's where I got to know the True Ventures guys. That's where I got to know the Josh Koppelman and First Round. That's where I got to know a bunch of the people who became my my friends. And so the way I look at it is it got me going. My second investment was Truvio, which was this video search engine very early on. And this one was a 17x outcome in 11 months. And so, you know, I'm more than made up with Truvio for my losses with Fitster.
Interesting. What was it that's, that in the first place got you kind of doing this? I mean, how does somebody go from, I presume you had your own startups before this, is that right?
Yep. Well, in the financial services market back in France, we built a company that essentially brought Sun workstations in trading floors in France, then Europe, then the U.S., and we ended up being acquired by Reuters after 5 years in 93.
So were you the founder? Were you the geek in charge of that?
Or? No, I was one of the early developers who became the CTO of the company and then one of the key tech guys at Reuters eventually. Cool.
Yeah. How did you get then from France to wagering 40K on Feedster? I mean, what's the road you take in between those two? Because that, now you're here in Silicon Valley.
Yes, I am. And so in 2000, after going through the Euro transition, the Millennium transition, and putting in place the 35-hour week in my shop in France, which disgusted me from, you know, ever talking to a Frenchman ever again. essentially, I moved to the U.S. in August of 2000 to become a VC. So I made the transition from sort of operator technical guy to VC guy, not so much because I was very fond of the VC business per se, but I really, really wanted to move to Silicon Valley. And that was sort of a great opportunity for me to do something different. And every now and then in my career, I've, you know, gone on the whim to do something radically different, like getting into the world of finance back in 1988 by absolute randomness. And that worked out pretty well. In 2004, after 4 years as a traditional VC, I saw this new generation of companies popping up, the those Web 2.0 companies that were tremendously capital efficient, that essentially could get off the ground for $500K as opposed to the traditional $5 million Series A's that they were raising in 2000. And I thought, gee, this is actually interesting. I should go do that. And decided that the best way to do it was actually to leave the VC firm I was part of, start my own, and essentially become a full-time angel investor to start with or to begin with, because no one in their right mind would have actually given me money to manage at that time, since I didn't have any track record. And Web 2.0 was so nascent that there was absolutely zero proof or even concept of it being, you know, something that we know now, you know, having created Facebook, Twitter, and those kinds of companies.
You got to have some skin in the game before anybody would trust you with their skin. And,
yep.
And that's the way to do it. We're talking to Jeff Clavier, who is a venture capitalist, former angel investor, and runs as managing partner of SoftTech VC. We're going to talk. I want to talk about how companies, how this all works and how it's changed over the years, because you've seen it all change dramatically since the bubble and the bust. But let's take a break first and talk a little bit about getting away from the post office. This is the kind of idea that if somebody came to me and said, I want to pitch you something. What if you didn't need a postage meter? You didn't need to buy special inks. You didn't need to go to the post office. You could just have your printer print stamps.
You're crazy.
Yeah.
No one will ever let
you'd say
happen.
That. No, that's counterfeiting. You can't do that. Well, somebody somewhere, I think the post office, probably what happened, somebody went to the U.S. Postal Service and said, guys, you don't want people in your lobby. You don't want to pay for clerks. You just want to make money. So here's what we'll do. We'll make it possible, using this neat new technology, to let people print their own postage from their computer and printer. And you get the, you know, you get the lion's share of the money. We'll just take a little bit. Everybody's happy. Apparently, the Postal Service made it illegal around the year 2000, and Stamps.com was born. And what a great idea for a business. Here's the idea. Stamps.com is on the Mac or the PC. You get a USB scale, so it plugs right into the computer. You throw your package on there. Stamps.com always knows exactly the right postage because it's online, right? I mean, it's checking. It it will print out exactly the right postage. If you're mailing internationally, this is something Jeff could use. It's a real pain to mail stuff internationally. You've got to get a special postal order. It does it all for you and fills out the forms, the customs forms, everything. Prints them all out, and you're good to go. You get discounts. You can't get at the post office because the Postal Service wants you to use this. So you get, what is it? I have it here. I think it's like 21%, up to 21% off of express mail. You get up to 15% off priority mail. And you might say, well, I still have to schlep the package. No. Then the postal carrier comes and picks it up. Or if you've missed the pickup, you call them. They'll give you a free pickup. Because really, frankly, they want to be in this business. This is good for you. Keith, Stamps.com.
Keith512 says you missed the gossip in the line at the post office. But that's what Twitter and Facebook's for. You don't need that either.
I don't think the gossip. The only reason I can think of that you might want to go to the post office, maybe you want to hit on that cute postal clerk. That's the only reason. You don't have to do that anymore. You can just do it from your desk. And let me tell you something. We've got a great trial offer. Use the offer code triangulation. Now, here's how it works. You got to do this just right. Go to Stamps.com. Now, you're going to see an $80 offer on the front page. No. Click the link at the top on the upper right-hand corner. There's like a microphone, like a old-fashioned microphone. Click that. That's the secret Easter egg. And then use the offer code triangulation. It goes from $80 to $110 bonus offer. You get the scale. You get a month's free stamps.com, and you get $55 free postage. $55. So see that? 80? No. Use a special back entrance. Triangulation. They say radio. I think they don't understand this is a podcast. That's okay. It says radio. Just ignore that. Just write triangulation. It's okay. It's
the future of radio.
It's the future of radio.
$110.
Look at that. I just gave you a bunch of extra.
And you get that. That covers the scale.
Scale, too. Nice. You pay shipping and handling for the scale, but it's not much. It is a great deal. Stamps.com. And believe me, not going to the post office, not waiting in line, not finding parking, not wasting your time is so nice. You will love it. I've been using this since they started in about 2000, and I just love it. Stamps.com. Give it a try today. See, Jeff, I bet you would have invested. If that was my pitch, wouldn't you have invested in that?
That looks like something sort of heavy on regulation, and we like the fact that you don't have to deal with, you know, something as big as USPS, you know, to get your company to scale.
It's kind of interesting. You know, we have seen a complete shift. You said it yourself. These Web 2.0 companies are very inexpensive. You can launch fast. You can iterate fast. You could put it on Amazon, EC2.
Is it because of the dot-com bust where they're like, yeah, there's not 5 million sitting around anymore?
What happened?
What started that?
Well, it's actually because you mentioned it, the cost of technology. So EC2, S3 are making it a no-brainer for companies to get, you know, half of a server or a third of a server sort of up in the cloud.
Right.
The fact that you're building on top of the rest of the Web 2.0 stack, you only focus on the few things that are your specific features and differentiation, and you don't get to rebuild, you know, the entire stack, which we used to do back in the day. And the cost of building those things require less people. So you used to have, you know, 5 to 10 people, and now you have like 2 or 3 co-founders putting together the first version of a product. Look at Instagram, which is sort of almost the extreme.
Two guys!
Sort of two guys got this off the ground, and then three, and then four, and they had basically one guy per million users up until they broke that, and now they have like, you know, whatever, 3 million users per guys or something, which is just insane. Why? Because they just focus on the experience that they want to deliver with their service, and they don't care about the rest of the stack. And so if you compound cost of infrastructure, cost of development, no software because everything is open source, you just shrink the cost of development. However, I would just point to this thing that people sometimes misunderstand. It doesn't cost much to get going and to prove something, but if you want to scale and build a really big company, you will still have to raise, you know, $25 to $50 million. The point is the cost of failure, which is how much you need to spend, you know, to figure out it was a bad idea in the first place,
right,
is in the $250 to $500, as opposed to $2.5 million to $5 million, which was the case in the past.
Huge change and really good for innovation. So some of the people we're talking to are young guys and gals. Maybe they're in college. Maybe they're studying computer science, as you did. If you were talking to them, and or these were your kids, and you were saying what they should do to take advantage of this amazing kind of economy of scale, what would you tell them? What should they learn? What should they do?
Well, first and foremost is understand the tools that are available to you. So, you know, hack open source software, play, you know, build prototypes of iPhone apps, build websites, use everything which is available in the arsenal to understand how best you can leverage what is, whatever is available to you.
It's not just Ruby on Rails anymore. It's there's a lot of choices out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's figure out what's sort of interesting, what you're passionate about, what you're going to have fun with, and try many different things. Don't try and just narrow yourself to just one piece of technology or one language. And then, if ever you have the opportunity to intern with an interesting startup and, you know, ask that for intros in that case, do that because it will give you exposure to other entrepreneurs and other startups so that you can figure out what that means to actually do this. The challenge we see with first-timers, so people who have just fresh out of college or college dropouts do their startups, is they don't really understand what it takes to actually bring those to scale, whether it's culture, whether it's hiring, whether it's, you know, dealing with users at scale. And so unless you have a burning desire to do it on your own immediately, I would say go hang out with, you know, interesting startups, and you will sort of use that as a launch pad for your own ideas a bit later on.
You got a lot of learning to do. Do you agree with Peter Thiel that people should not even waste time in college?
You know, it's that's a tough one. I know that if ever my son was telling me, and he just got into high school, so we have some time.
Less than you think.
We'll see that.
It goes fast.
I've had that question from founders about, hey, you know,
do I need a degree?
I really want to do this startup, and I want to just drop out. Mm-hmm. And if you have this burning desire to do it, and you have this passion, and you just think about this, then the good news is that in the U.S. you can actually take sort of a leave of absence and, mm-hmm. you know, try something for a couple of years, and if it doesn't work, then you can come back and finish your degree. At the end of the day, people always sort of focus on the successes and you know, the few dropouts who became really
Mark
successful.
Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs. Yeah, there's some pretty big names in that club.
But how many of, you know, for those three guys, how many actually completely failed? And, you know, maybe would have actually fared better if they had gotten their graduation, you know, done and then done their startup. So I think there's a bit of risk management to be done here. Obviously, if you want to throw yourself into it and take the maximum risk, then, you know, you should do it because people actually accept that in Silicon Valley. That's the one thing which I saw as a major difference between, you know, the Valley and the rest of the entrepreneur world that I see around, you know, Europe or France, UK, and so on and so forth, is this acceptance of taking risk and therefore failure being just part of the journey. And if ever you fail, that's fine. Just get back up and do it again, which is an awesome opportunity given that there's much less pressure around the impact of failure here than anywhere else.
Do you think that Silicon Valley can be recreated in other places around the world? And there's examples where you can point to, like Israel, for instance, where there's, you know, a really good technology scene. But Silicon Valley seems to be, as you decided, the place to be for innovation. And places like Europe and France in particular are often held up as the opposite, which is why Loic does Le Web. He's like, we're trying to bring some of that spirit over and get it going over there. Why is it that Silicon Valley is that place, and is it possible to replicate that?
So, as you said, Tom, there's many countries who have tried to figure out how to recreate their own Silicon Valley. And I think that just that very premise is a mistake, because Silicon Valley was born and built over 40 years as the confluence of, you know, technology. So originally military technology, Stanford and Berkeley, and this nascent sort of venture capital world that started, you know, 40 years ago, where you had a bunch of guys who had, you know, single-digit million-dollar funds, and they were getting together to actually build those big companies like, you know, the ones we have now. And there is this notion of intrinsic support of the ecosystem, so that if ever you can help your, you know, buddy entrepreneur, even without knowing exactly how it's going to benefit you, you will still do it, because we all fundamentally understand that paying it forward is the way to go. And to be honest, this notion doesn't really exist anywhere else, where a lot of times you're going to try and figure out, you know, what's in it for me before you try and help someone else. And so when, you know, the French government or the UK government has asked me, how can we recreate our own Silicon Valley? It's about getting the components, you know, of existing companies, sort of facilitating the creation of startups and making entrepreneurs sort of the heroes of the day, as opposed to established companies, and then facilitating the money side. And if ever you can get those three ingredients, then you actually have something which could potentially work. And if you look at the recent developments in London and in Berlin, it's starting to work reasonably, I would say nicely, it's still nascent, but there's more of an ecosystem now in Europe than I've seen over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, we look at SoundCloud out of Berlin, and how much of it's the educational system, too? It's very different in France, for instance. You get tracked very early on.
Yep. So I'm not sure exactly how it is now, because by definition, we've left 12 years ago. But in my time, if you wanted to have the best teachers in math and physics, you had to go through German as a first language, English as a second language, and Latin. And unfortunately, I don't use my Latin every day. I should.
I'm glad I studied it, but I'm not sure it's a useful thing to study.
We were going to do a Latin version of triangulation, but
we decided not to.
Yeah, we couldn't find the numbers working out.
We couldn't agree. He wanted to do church Latin. I wanted to do classic Latin.
High Latin is really more, being Catholic where I come from.
Yeah. No, we're just teasing.
And so the challenge at that time is you had that path, as you said,
I think you still do, Jeff. I mean, my daughter who studied high school in France a couple of years ago was a junior in high school. And her friends who were French, you know, they're studying very hard in secondary school for those exams to get into the fac that they want to get into. But you get in, and that's it, and it's done. And you're studying to be a doctor at the age 18, and for the next 8 years, that's all you're doing, and you're tracked.
And for us, if you have this sort of golden path or golden track, right, which is prep schools, where you you do those for 2 years, and then there is an exam, and depending as to how well you do at the exam, you will get into the best French school, right, or second best French school, whatever. And the problem is that you're not learning anything that is actually useful.
And it discourages risk.
And it's boring. That's why I basically dropped out of the prep schools. And to be candid, that's one of the best decisions I've made in my life, because if I hadn't dropped out and decided that I would just go do computer science and hang out in the computer lab, I'm not sure where I would be or what I would do. But this sort of very decision sort of allowed me to get into computer science and really sort of like it. And so I did my major in computer science and my minor in distributed computing, which led me into doing this startup in the financial services market, and, you know, give me this notion that, hey, you can take risk and actually still do okay.
Right.
And I'm sort of sad that in the French system, even though people understand that it's important to spend time in startups or established companies, they don't get enough exposure to the real world at school. And that's what I find sort of sad, to be honest.
Every country now, though, wants to have the kind of innovative culture that we have here in the States. But you've got so much to create.
Other areas of the States want to have.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's so much. You've got to create the financing superstructure. You've got to have the education. You have to have support for failure, as you said. People have to be willing to take risks and it not be a stigma if you fail. Brent Hoberman has said that, the British entrepreneur, that, you know, the big problem in Europe is that it's not okay to fail. But I think that's changing, isn't it, Jeff? I mean, there seems to be this exciting culture all over the world now of entrepreneurism.
It is definitely changing. And, you know, I will always remember my when I told my dad that I was going to do a startup back in when I was 22. And he looks at me and he says, you know, your mother and I, which for him meant that he was going to say something serious, my mother and I.
He's bringing in the big guns.
Absolutely. And he said, you know, your mother and I, you know, always expected that you would have a good job because you always had, you know, great grades. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, like a lifetime career at Thomson or, you know, the equivalent of PG&E, you know, in France or whatever, which was at that time deemed being a good job, because if you were an entrepreneur, it meant that you couldn't find someone that was going to hire you. And so you had to start your own business, right? And I think that this has fundamentally changed, thank God.
Yes.
However, the stigma of failure is still not there. And to me, when I talk to, I've spent quite a bit of time with the UK government and the French government guys who were trying to sort of prop all this entrepreneurship, set of programs. And I said, you have to celebrate entrepreneurship much more than you do today. Because if you look at the US, obviously, we don't sort of recognize that per se because it's part of the day-to-day. But, you talk about Drew Houston, you talk about Mark Zuckerberg, you talk about the accomplished young entrepreneurs almost as a reference. And yes, you have the Steve Jobs and, the Bill Gates and so on and so forth, but the younger guys are always on the front page. And it's barely the case out there in Europe where, yeah, you might hear about a SoundCloud or a Spotify, but, you should sort of have more celebration of early success. And the fact that those guys completely legitimate sort of entrepreneurship as a different path. And the one thing which really sort of made me really sad 2 years ago was a sort of a survey of French graduates right after the baccalaureate, and people sort of asked them, okay, what do you guys want to do? What's a great sort of job for you? What's a great career? And 70% of them roughly said that they wanted to work for the government.
Right.
And be in
civil service,
Civil service.
Yep.
And that's just
horrible. Depressing.
it's security over, it's the opposite of risk.
Yeah, it's job security. But the problem is that there's no such thing as job security in the world, right?
Right.
And that's
not
why.
Not anymore.
No. That's why there is this need to really sort of publicize and almost sort of put entrepreneurs on a pedestal so that they can become role models and aspirations for the younger generations.
Yeah, I feel like what the internet has done, and it's far from done it, but what it's made possible is those tools to become an innovator and become an entrepreneur are now easier to get a hold of than ever. It goes back to what you were talking about earlier. You can use an EC2 and a few, plug and play sort of web software modules, take your idea and get it up and running.
At least
like
you get
that.
A demo.
Yeah.
You could start iterating. And then I presume the next step, Jeff, is that's when you go to somebody and say, okay, can you give me some money? Because I need to build this business. And for you as an investor, I'm sure that makes it much easier to invest because you can see something.
Yep. And essentially what's interesting is even comparing now, 2012, to when I started in 2005, if you look at what entrepreneurs, come to you with in terms of a product which is in alpha or beta with users that you can sort of look at some behavior, whether it's, how hard it was to acquire them, what sort of retention the product has, testing a bunch of different things. You can really sort of look at an application that could have a few hundred, a few thousand, or a few hundred thousand users, even if the company is bootstrapped. And so the bar of our own expectations, if you want, has gone higher and higher over time because it's so cheap now to prove something. And, now we're sort of joking that if a company has launched last week on the App Store and doesn't have, a million users, there's something wrong with it. But at the end of the day, if you think about how hard it was back in the day to get to, a million users, that was a real accomplishment. Whereas now, this is sort of almost a trivial milestone. For those companies.
But isn't there a negative too then? Because a company that can't go viral might have a great idea, might have an idea that's a sustainable idea, might be, in fact, the next great company, but just not viral growth right up front. Is that company disadvantaged by this kind of system?
Well, yes and no. Because at the end of the day, what you do as an investor is you look at the different profiles of companies. And as you pointed out, Leo, not everything is viral, right? And so you have to look at the essentially, step back and look at three components, right? The team and how strong it is, the product and how differentiated, interesting, potentially sort of becoming a disruptor or leader in a space, and then the market opportunity, which is if ever this company sort of manages to get off the ground and prove itself, what sort of company are we building? Is it, a $100 million company in 5 years kind of thing?
Right.
And if ever you can say yes to all those three questions, you have something which is potentially interesting. And some will, have some viral components and you're going to test them and figure out that, you know, virality works for that type of application, and it better have a bunch of users, you know, because if it's viral, and some others will just go and acquire users the old-fashioned way. But if you feel that this is an interesting application that is providing, you know, utility or community and so on and so forth, then you can get the user acquisition, activation, retention equation to work. And in that case, you know, it can scale as well. You just have to understand the profile and type of application you're building.
So we have an interesting question from Furniture Guy in the chat room, which I wonder if
not his real name.
If he's got a furniture, well, I don't know.
Maybe it is his real name. I don't know.
But he wants to hear what are some of your misses. You're very well known for your successes. What are some of your failures that you learned from that you took a lot away from?
So if I could go back in time and change one decision, that would be passing on LinkedIn's Series A.
Yeah, that's a good one not to pass on. Our friend Loic did not pass on that, I think.
Loic, so, you know, there were 13 angels. I was supposed to be the 14th, and I can't even spell properly why I sort of passed. It was a mix of feeling it was a bit too expensive, no clear monetization. I guess I chickened at the last minute, and so that's completely my bad. But yes, Loic and a bunch of my friends actually invested, and I'm really happy for them for the outcome. So that's really my number one biggest mistake. I would say I passed on Twilio for a question of valuation, which was kind of stupid of me. I didn't see how Foursquare could turn into a business. I still can't see how Foursquare turns into a business. But anyway, and so I sort of didn't investigate on that one. More recently, I passed on Pinterest, like everyone else in the Valley. So I feel in good company here.
Who knew, though? I mean how can you tell? How can you look at something like Pinterest, which is just looks like Tumblr? What are you looking at to say, oh, this has got – you can see how it could monetize. But it's just another – also, it's just like everybody else.
Well, it's like Foursquare. It's like Twitter. When you look at it, you're like, I don't know that this is going to be huge.
Foursquare, I guess you could see where that might go somewhere. But LinkedIn, I think you missed a boat. But but Pinterest,
I agree.
Who knew? Who knew? I mean, really.
You know, remember, okay, let's go back in time, right? It's the end of 2003. You're in the race for the guy with the, you know, most connections, and that's 50 right. connections, and there's maybe, you know, a few tens of thousands of people on the platform. So I screwed up and I should have.
It was small though. It was very, very small.
It was small for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, the one big mistake I made is to doubt Reed as a fantastic entrepreneur, one of the best of our time. And, you know, I should just have said, okay, fine, it's Reed, you'll figure it out. And that's the only sort of real screw up in the equation. Because if you look at the fundamentals of LinkedIn at that time, you know, I can't say that I was, that the rationale that I used to actually pass was wrong. What I made a mistake on was to underestimate how good Reed was.
What percentage of that decision is based on the founder or founders?
So we look at those three components, the founder, the product, and the market opportunity. And so the actual answer to your question is think about, you know, having a scale, and each and every component of the deal, whether it's the founding team, whether it's the product, the differentiation, you know, is it a noisy market or not? You know, is it a disruption or market creation? And everything sort of is a set of weights you put on the scale.
Right,
and at some point, the scale is going to tilt.
Right.
But if you were to sort of rationalize how much is the founder, the product, and the market, I would say, you know, between 40 and 60% is the founder, between 20 and 30% is the product, and the rest is the market opportunity.
But what you're saying is a weaker founder could be made up for by a great product. It can the scale shifts depending on, and it can be different factors that make it be a strong investment.
And you know, weak founder is always bad news. And so
it could be a great product with great monetization possibilities, but if the founder sucks, it doesn't matter. Does it go the other way? If you've got a great founder, if you've got a Reed Hastings, Reed Hoffman, can that make it better if it's a bad product? Because he could pivot, right?
Yeah, and some people will say, hey, if you really back the right horse, you know, it's
fine.
You're
betting on the horse.
Great, yeah.
Yeah.
But we have a hard time with those where if ever the product really, really sucks, yes, you could figure out that, you know, the team will sort of pivot into something interesting.
Right.
But we have a hard time with those bets. And so typically, if we like the team but not the product, we tell them, look, we love you guys, but this sucks, so we won't do it. And, you know, more often than not, we're right. So, you know, we certainly have passed on a few deals which we shouldn't have passed on. But, you know, the vast majority of what we passed on, we actually made the right decision.
I doubt there's any venture capitalist or angel in the world who can't say, oh, I missed that one. I mean, you do fish. If you fish, you're going to miss some big ones.
Well, remember, look at the numbers. We say no 99.5% right. of the time.
Are wow. there any real-life Case Pollards out there? She's the character from Pattern Recognition who's the cool hunter. Are there people you can go to? Maybe they're horrible at finance, they're horrible at investment, but you can say, like, this person just always knows. If I run the idea by it, they'll call it right.
There are a couple of guys, like my friend Kevin Hartz at Evenbright, is a superb angel investor. If you look at his track record, it's just absolutely stunning. He doesn't do a ton of investments, but everything he does. Recently, he was in Pinterest. He was in Airbnb. He was an early investor in PayPal. And so,
okay, those sound right.
he has built a massive portfolio, but the portfolio is just stunning. So there's a few guys like that. If you were to sort of just follow them, you would definitely do well. But, you know, you have to basically create your own sort of investment as a VC. You have to create your own investment thesis, figure out what your portfolio construction is going to be and the types of companies that you're going to want to put in the portfolio. For us, in this new fund, in Fund 3, which is a $55 million fund, we have three categories, next generation commerce, mobility, and SaaS, both horizontal, so infrastructure, and vertical, so peeking into a very specific sort of market. And we'll do, you know, 80% of the fund will invest in those three sectors, and we're very bullish about them. So, you know, that's our thesis.
We're going to take a break. We're talking to Jeff Clavier, who is a venture capitalist, and just everybody loves him. Which is unusual for venture capitalists in Silicon Valley. Well, not everybody. I'm sure there's somebody who doesn't. But for the most part, people just think the world of them. And it's so great to have you on, Jeff, and talk about that. I want to talk a little bit about why the valuations are so crazy, why the stock market's going so crazy for things like Groupon. One of our chatters, Byron, wants to know, how do they get these evaluations? We'll do that in just a little bit. First, though, let's talk about one of the oldest companies in the industrialized U.S., and yet it's still an innovator. And that is a big question. How do you do that? And I'm talking about the Ford Motor Company, that blue oval. That's Henry Ford's handwriting, that Ford there. I mean, that is a company where you had this genius. You know, Ford as a human wasn't a great human, but certainly as a thinker, brilliant, who came up with this idea, he built the Rouge factory, which is several you know, it's like 2 miles by 1.5 miles, giant area. The idea was a box car comes in with iron ore, with lumber, and a car, a Model T, comes out the other end. He created this whole brilliant notion. And now often companies have that innovator's dilemma. They can't continue to innovate. And here we are more than 100 years later, or almost, I guess it's very close to 100 years later. And Ford is still on the cutting edge. In fact, they've entered the 21st century, thanks, I think, to people like Alan Mulally, people who are, there's a new book about him called American Icon. I cannot wait. We got to get the guy who wrote that on to talk about. But they, through proper leadership, through innovation, have kept a step ahead.
Not, you know, too many companies that predate World War I.
You can't think of them.
Are still doing
it. I know. Yeah. IBM.
IBM.
But they
Which
pivoted.
Wasn't even called IBM.
They had a big pivot. Nintendo. Big pivot. They were a card playing card company. Nokia. What were they
doing?
Nice
rubber boots.
Rubber boots.
Back in the day.
Yeah, see, Ford's still making cars. Still making cars, and some of the best cars out there. One of the things that Henry Ford had, and this is, it's very interesting, this is still a fundamental belief of the company, is to make it affordable. When Henry Ford came along, cars were for the very, very wealthy. They actually came with their own mechanic and chauffeur. They came with somebody to drive and fix it. You know, you'd have to be a multimillionaire to have a car. He said, no, I want everybody to have a car. I want America to be a mobile society. And he transformed American society by doing so. And still today, when you look at things like Ford Sync, this, the technology Ford's putting in the car, sure, many of the very most high-end cars have similar advanced computer systems. Ford's making them in the most affordable cars they make, as well as the high-end cars. They are putting the best technology in there. Take a look at Ford Sync. I love the idea. You've got to solve this problem. People want to be connected when they get in the car. But we don't want them to be distracted. It's not safe. Keep your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road. You'll still be a great driver. But with Ford Sync, use voice technology to stay connected. And now with AppLink, they've got an API. They've got a developer network. They're supporting app developers to make apps that work with the computer in the car. So you still have the voice activation of things like Pandora, OpenBeak, Stitcher, Slacker Radio. Now iHeartRadio, I'm on that. So if you want to listen to our radio show, you can say, play the Tech Guy show, talk to the car, and it'll play it. You can iHeartRadio has the Thumb Play service, so using simple voice commands, you can find save stations, skip to the next song, give a thongs a thumbs up. NPR is on the app platform, and Ford is reaching out to developers. They have the Mobile Application Developer Network to have developers work with Ford to get your app on the platform. This is exciting. I mean, Ford really realized that all the innovations happening in mobile, we can't iterate the car faster. You keep a car for 5-10 years, but you change your phone, you add new apps. If we can only make the two work together, and they figured it out. It's the only company that's doing this. I want you to visit Ford.com/technology, but better yet, go to a Ford dealer near you and drive one today. Great vehicles, affordable vehicles, living up to that dream that Henry Ford had to make cars available for everybody and have the latest technology. Ford.com/technology. We're so glad to be part of the Ford family. We thank them for their support. Jeff Clavier is our guest on Triangulation. When you look at Groupon and their valuation... you know, they turned down, what did they turn down from Google? $600 million? And they were right.
No, $6 billion.
They turned down $6 billion. But they were right? Or were they?
Well, so disclosures. So one of my companies, GoodRec, was acquired by Groupon early on. And so I'm actually a shareholder in Groupon. But I'm so small that it doesn't really matter.
You could tell the truth.
I would definitely mention that. So... if you look at Groupon's sort of valuation when they IPO'd, yeah, definitely they were way over $6 billion. However, now they're definitely getting into trouble because
Shareholder lawsuits, it's called. Yeah.
Well, they have essentially yesterday, Sarah Lacy wrote a really sort of great post on Pendo Daily around at the end of the day, Groupon went public way too early. And after 3 years building a completely different sort of business model and trying to compete with, Yellow Pages on one side, creating a local marketplace on the other, and something which hasn't been attempted before, it was clear that there was going to be a lot of accounting issues and backlog issues before it can stabilize. And she made the point that if Facebook had gone public 2-3 years ago or 4 years ago, it would have been a nightmare. And I think that it's what we're seeing with Groupon. So I think that there is a lot of issues to iron out for the Groupon management team before it's actually stable and able to build a really sort of interesting company. As to whether they will be able to do that with, you know, the entire public eye, you know, looking at them, including the SEC.
Right.
And I think I'd rather take the public eye than the SEC in this context. We'll see what comes out. And certainly I haven't sort of looked at their stock today, but they plunged pretty badly. So let's see where they are.
Is that the problem with going public, is that you're suddenly public?
Well, yeah. You're public, you're accountable, you have to obey to a set of very specific rules. And if ever you sort of come back and say, well, you know, I sort of thought I had made a $15 million profit, but I actually have a $15 million loss.
Whoops.
My bad. It just doesn't work, right?
Right.
And so to me, what they've built is pretty unique. And I do think that eventually there is value in that asset. However... they're really just sort of running into trouble. And I think that 2012 is going to be a pretty challenging year for them, to sort of get all those things ironed out and figured out.
Facebook isn't going to have much of a choice about going public because of the SEC regulations. But if they could put it off, should Facebook put it off their IPO?
I think Mark has really tried to put it off as much. Oh, yeah, sorry. We sold the company to Facebook, so we're also Facebook shareholders. Sorry.
And also you're doing good, company, Jeff. And we'll how can I invest in Jeff Clavier? That's what I want to invest in.
we're also small shareholders, but, you know, I'm going to put my my disclosures out.
Yeah, no, I'm glad. Thank you.
And so in terms of Facebook, I think that Mark has been clear that he didn't want to go public too early. However, because of the 500 shareholder rule and the fact that his own sort of employees want to go public to get this this sort of outcome or massive sort of outcome for themselves, you know, thousands and thousands of millionaires out of the early Facebook employees, he doesn't really have much of a choice. But yes, he's going to have to live up to the scrutiny of the public market. And, you know, what was interesting recently is he didn't even show up for investors' meetings during the roadshow, meaning, okay, you know, some people are going to take care of that, but I'm just going to deal with the product. Thank you very much. And we'll see how we can sort of create that culture of, look, we're here to build a business that really sort of has customers in as a first order of priority. And yes, we'll do well for you guys as investors, but, you know, we won't sort of be there for Wall Street and look at, you know, quarterly dividends and so on and so forth, which is, to be honest, one of the challenges for those companies, because they're just not geared towards, you know, the quarterly dividend and results, you know, sort of cycle. Because think about Facebook launching, you know, some of their innovations and the backlash they got, and, you know, eventually it sort of all worked out for the better and they keep on growing. But if you were to sort of put, okay, every quarter you have to look at the numbers and people are going to be sort of asking why you did this and why you did that, and this whole sort of expectation of the street for you to deliver on certain, you know, profits and potential dividends is sort of countercyclical.
But how do you end up with, let's say, a company like Twitter, who haven't gone public, they're not going to go public anytime very soon, getting valuations of $9.2 billion when we're not even sure that they have a monetization strategy? It's hard to tell sometimes. How do those incredibly large valuations come about? I think that's what Brian is wanting to know. What is that based on?
So That's actually a question.
And you haven't sold a company to Twitter.
It's okay. Irrational exuberance.
Oh, actually, Tom, we did.
Oh.
Sorry.
But you're good at this. I'm telling you.
Well, you know, part of the art of being a VC is to know when to sell things as
That's
well.
Right.
So,
that's right.
So the challenge with a lot of valuations out there, and you talk about Twitter, but there's a lot of questions around, you know, how do you get to a $4 billion valuation to Dropbox, which is an uber awesome product, and you know, the infrastructure of the fund is actually based around Dropbox. But, you know, we've sort of trivialized the $1 billion valuation over the past year and a half, where it used to mean something to reach $1 billion. And now, you know, people say, well, you know, there was a rumor the other day that Pinterest's next round would be $1 billion. You know, it's cool. But what the hell does that mean, right? In terms of actual revenue, actual footprint, and so on and so forth. And so to answer your question, Tom, it's just a question of, you know, if you have investors who are bullish enough to pay that price or that premium because they believe that they can still make a profit on that valuation, they will just step up and you know, invest at that price.
That
I remember a friend of mine. Yeah, no, basically it's market, you know, it's a market economy. And so as
I guess,
long as
I guess what the question is what's making them think that?
Well, that you'd have to ask them.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. And that's where, you know, if you look at our portfolio in Fund 3, we've actually erred towards the side of building businesses. And most of our companies today have a pretty clear, defined business model, whether it's you know, transactions, whether it's a SaaS model, whether it's subscriptions, whether it's, you know, basically you make money one way. And the question is how far or how high can you scale that, as opposed to, hey, let's build a maximum footprint and then eventually we'll figure out how to build the revenue engine.
But that's how Twitter and Facebook did it, right?
Well, Facebook has been making money for a long, long time.
Yeah, and they knew how they were going to make money, right?
And they knew pretty well how. But the one thing which was clear in Mark's sort of mind was that he would put the user experience and the scale of the platform in advance of the revenues. And so, you know, I won't say that they did $4 billion in revenue without trying, because I don't think it's true, but it's still, you know, a scale of revenue which is very, very respectable, shall we say, versus Twitter, which, you know, has a massive goodwill and, you know, massive footprint, but still lags tremendously in terms of revenue scale.
So they're a cautionary tale for new companies.
I'm not sure whether it's, I mean, look, there are still people buying their shares at 8 billion or 9 billion or whatever. So I'm not sure whether it's a cautionary tale. But at some point, you have to catch up to it.
Right.
Right. Because fundamentally, the street works on revenue multiples and last time I checked, you know, profit multiple.
So one of the things that changed in the jobs bill, which I think will be signed tomorrow, were you a supporter of the jobs bill? I presume
yes.
You were. Yeah.
Yes.
Is that 500 threshold, 500 investor threshold now goes to 2,000. 2,000 people can have a stake in your company before you have to go public. That's positive, I would imagine. But it also makes it possible for startups to explicitly say, we're at demo to get money today, which obviously they were, but now they can say it. It allows more small investors. So things like Kickstarter can be legal. All of those things you think are good things?
Yes. So a couple of things. One is the 500 shareholder rule becoming 2,000 means that you can stay private for a longer time and choose your own thing and not be forced to go public like it sort of happened to Google and Facebook.
Gotcha.
The crowdfunding sort of opportunity is really enabling other types of companies to receive funding from the public. And there will be a set of, you know, rules, regulations to sort of make sure that there's everybody sort of crowdfunding of the potential, you know, next generation of Ponzi schemes or Madoff because of that act, which obviously people will have to be careful about, you know, where they put their money. But eventually, you have to remember that only a small percentage of the startups or companies created every day in the U.S. are subject to venture capital and have the kind of potential scale and ramp that works for us as VCs. Because when we invest in a company, we expect, you know, if it works, at least 10x, you know, to make our own fund math work. And there's a bunch of companies out there that might be really good cash flow type businesses, but that don't really sort of work for us and would work for more traditional personal investor. And so the Crowdfunding Act is really to try and make this easier for this type of companies to attract a financing that would typically not come from us. So a lot of people have said, well, you guys are sort of disrupting yourselves. And the answer is no, because when we invest money, the money part is actually a commodity. It's more the support, the help, the value add that we have to offer as investors. And if you can't get this kind of value-added money, then you might want to go somewhere else to try and grab your financing. And we think that the Crowdfunding Act could actually help with that.
So in other words, it's not going to affect where you put your money. It's going to enable some other businesses to come along and sort of fill in a gap right now that is not a good investment for you to begin with.
And yes, and also remember that this sort of bar that I mentioned, which has gone higher and higher over the past 8 years, because you can do so much with, you know, trap startup. Well, not everyone can bootstrap, and so there's still room for what we call friends and family financing, which could end up being a Kickstarter type crowdfunding, where, you know, a couple of founders will get their first 200K or 100K or 50K from a bunch of people to get going and quit their jobs and work for 6 months to actually build this initial product and traction that we, as the next level up of investors, will want to see. And so, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and if I get this right, what it does is, right now, Kickstarter, you can get money, but you can't promise that anybody gets anything.
You're not an investor.
You're not an owner.
You're a giver.
And what this changes is now I can say, if you give me money on Kickstarter, I'll give you a slice of the company.
Right.
Is that right?
I should do that. We're talking to Jeff. We got a few more minutes with Jeff Clavier. When we come back, I want to talk about the great burden on innovation that our current patent software patent system and how it, from his point of view, how it affects his investments. Jeff is a managing partner at SoftTechVC.com, and a great resource, obviously, you could tell, for the companies that he invests in terms of just knowledge and background and history. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about Vast Conference. I bet you Jeff does a few conference calls. We do them all the time. And we found a really great system that's worked very well for us called Vast Conference. Now, if you're doing audio-only conference calling, I want you to check this out. They've actually set it up so that you can make two free Vast Conference calls. Actually, you get 300 minutes to try out the service. by using the offer code triangulation. Triangulation, that's easy to remember. Why do I like Vast? Well, a few things. First of all, it's not VoIP. They're using very high-quality switches for very clear quality. They've got a great call management interface, which lets you manage users and callers. For instance, when you're on a call, you can name the callers, have independent recordings of each caller, go back and listen to an individual, you know, what did he say? You can, as an MP3 file, you don't need any special equipment. They have detailed usage tracking and billing codes for your internal accounting purposes. Very affordable, and you only pay for what you use. 2.5 cents per minute for regular calls. And if you want to offer, say you're having a conference call with a client, you don't want them to pay the toll, you can offer them an 800 number, a toll-free number for 6 cents a minute. And you decide. You get your own Vast conference number, and you decide which number you're going to give which client. So you can give your colleague the paid number, and you give your client the 800 number. Very easy. No commitment, no contract. You pay only for calls you host. And I tell you, if you do it, if you try it right now, you will see how good it sounds. And we use the recording feature all the time because it's really nice to have those recordings. VastConference.com. When you sign up, use the offer code triangulation so you can get your first 300 minutes free. That's could be two calls with five callers for half an hour, or you do the math. You can figure it out. One call with one person for 300 minutes, whatever. I know that's an awfully long call, but anyway.
A lot of business.
I would like to talk to you for 5 hours. It's really, actually, it's a good deal to try it free, but we want you to do this. Fiber optic lines, great teleconferencing equipment, so you get really good sounding calls. Up to 300 callers at once, by the way. Now, if you did
you don't need
300
that.
Callers, you'd only have a one-minute conference call.
That's right, for free.
My suggestion is not to have that first conference call with 300 people.
But figure most of conference calls are around three people and around 50 minutes.
That's good.
You've got two meetings to try.
You've got two of those, yeah. So that's great. VastConference.com, I'm sorry. We love them, and I know you will, too. Use the offer code triangulation, if you would. So Jeff Clavier is our guest. A few more minutes before This Week in Radio Technology, I wanted to ask about, it's a hot topic for us. We talk about it all the time, software patents and the kind of the burden on innovation. Do you see this in your business, too?
Oh, sure. The challenge we have is that, you know, a lot of our companies will file their provisional patent, you know, to have one or two, you know, in the arsenal. But at the end of the day, you can't use it to defend yourself because, by definition, patent trolls or large companies that will come after you will be doing that with a much bigger sort of balance sheet. And unfortunately, I've seen companies that were really interesting, innovative, being shut down because someone said, hey, you're infringing our patent. You know, we'll just get your IP. Otherwise, we'll just sue you guys up to, the end of your bank account. And founders typically don't have a choice because they don't have
they can't defend themselves. Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's unfortunately, you know, stifling innovation to have a system where companies can actually hoard a bunch of patents and start, you know, trolling. And the most recent example is sort of Yahoo that has used their early patents to just go after Facebook. And I think people are definitely cheering the fact that Facebook didn't, you know, sort of cave and settle. They just said, okay, Yahoo, you know, F you. And we're going to counter sue and use patents that we've also sort of either built, licensed, or actually received. And I think that in that countersuit, one of the patents actually was received just in the last 24 hours, or granted in the last 24 hours.
And it was
hours.
From a former Yahoo employee that they received, is what I heard. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Which makes it even sort of more savory, doesn't it? And so it's a gigantic waste of time, money, effort, and management bandwidth on both sides. And what the hell is Scott Thompson sort of thinking that in order to get Yahoo back on track, the first thing he does is to sue Facebook? Because, okay, he might get a settlement or whatever, but that's not going to change the, you know, the fate of Yahoo as a dying property, right? And so, I don't know, it's been sort of pretty shocking to witness that. And it's really sad that software patents as they exist today enables that. So I hope that at some point someone's going to say, okay, we just have to stop that because we're basically, you know, remember that stifling innovation in the U.S. means that there is a bunch of companies that can't get off the ground and can't create jobs. And so there's a direct impact on productivity, on the kinds of things we can do. And if you start looking as a startup at the patent, you know, sort of landscape, it's a pretty giant minefield, and you have to sort of work around certain patents, you know, to make your own invention sort of work. And it's just a waste of time.
But patents are supposed to protect innovation. And
well, that's the funny thing, because you could be on either side of this.
To play it entirely naive, if someone, I don't care if they're a patent troll, comes to me and says, you're violating my patent, that means I'm not being innovative, right? Because they've already thought of it. Why isn't it working that way?
Because if you look, Tom, at most of the patents and the way they're written, they are so freaking broad,
right,
that they try and encompass every single thing. And, you know, they are sort of an art. They are sort of patent lawyers, God forbid, who are just specialized on doing that. And they have those, you know, ways to try and have broad statements. And unfortunately, the patent office doesn't do enough of a good job to just reject a bunch of those. And that's basically the argument Facebook is making with regards to Yahoo's patents, saying those shouldn't have been allowed in the first place because they are just so broad that they don't mean anything. And, you know, it's always an artifact. It's always something. It's always that. And there's always, like, so many claims that they try and sort of sustain that you could sort of claim almost having invented everything, including the internet, by the way, and it just doesn't work like that. So either they find a way to restrict the patent to really make them tied to a very specific innovation, or they just, you know, have to be ready to get a lot of those early patents essentially attacked in court to refute the fact that they had been allowed in the first place.
So what's the solution? I mean, I know Mark Cuban is one of the folks out there saying, let's just get rid of software patents altogether, that it's a useless exercise to try to do this. Do you go that far, or do you think we just need to reform the law? Or what do you think the solution to this is?
At the end of the day, if you look at how fast you can build a company in this environment and how you can benefit from distribution channel and reach on smartphones and social networks that we have never had before, patents are just a defense mechanism that you use to protect yourself. And if you were getting rid of them, I don't think that you would actually harm Facebook's ability to build its product and to continue sort of faring well. There is an interesting, you know, question around all those European knockoffs that are happening today in Europe, you know, with Rocket Internet, the Summer Brothers, where every time there is something that works in the U.S., they're going to copy it and launch it in different countries in Europe. You know, patents don't work in that case, right? No one is actually going after them saying, well, you know, you just are infringing our IP when you're copying, you know, Amazon, when you're copying Zappos, when you're copying Fab, when you're copying all that. And so patents don't work in that context, and they should. So they're really sort of stifling innovation on one side and don't protect you for crap on the other. So either you find a way to make this work, or I don't think that getting rid of them would actually harm anyone, because, you know, we would save God knows, you know, how many five and tens and 20 of thousands of dollars that we spend on fighting, you know, worthless patents just because we have to.
Jeff Clavier is a managing partner at SoftTech and in some ways a spokesman for the new generation of investors on the web. And it's so great to talk to you. We had fun talking in Paris at Le Web. I hope to see you in Paris in 2012.
Absolutely. I will be there.
Yeah, of course you will.
Will you be in London for Le Web London?
I haven't heard anything from Loic yet. Loic. we would like to. I think some of us will. I think Sarah's going to go. We'll have somebody there. Jeff, thank you so much for taking an hour on your vacation, his workcation. He's at Kirkwood. He's skiing. You came out off the slopes to join us, and I'm very, very grateful.
Thank you so much for having me. That was
so great
fun
to talk to you. Thank you so much. We do this show every Wednesday. Gosh, I love doing it, too. We get a chance to talk to such interesting people.
Oh, we forgot to mention Le Rendezvous Tech. Patrick Beja, good friend of our show.
Jeff's a guest on that show on a regular basis.
I've been doing it for 3 years now, yeah.
You have to speak French, but what the heck?
I can see. Well, you know, it's funny because I every now and then ask Patrick, how do you say that in French? Because after 12 years in the U.S., my French is pretty badly damaged now.
But he spent so much time talking to his English podcasters, he doesn't know either.
it's Les Rendezvous?
Le Rendezvous Tech, yeah.
Le Rendezvous Tech.
And you can find it where? I'm going to ask.
It's a frenchspin.com? Is that? Is that right still?
FrenchSpin.com it is. I just Googled it. It's
no
amazing.
Watch.
The
no
amazing
watch.
Google.
No watch.
NoWatch.net is the new
one. Oh, okay.
Home.
Okay.
Yep.
So
big shout out to our friend at NutPatrick.
Yeah, he's great. And you're at Jeff because you were smart enough to realize that this Twitter thing was going somewhere. Jeff Clavier, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you again.
We do this show 5 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m., I'm sorry, Pacific every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern time, or 17 plus, right at midnight UTC. So you can watch if you're outside of the U.S. Please do tune in. We like to do it live because then we get to get questions from the chat room. We used quite a few this week, so thank you, chat room. If you miss a show, though, don't worry. You can always catch it on audio or video by going to twit.tv and downloading it. Best thing to do, subscribe, then you won't miss an episode. Who is next week? Do we know?
I can tell you. I have it in a tab right here.
It's in his tab.
Phil Libin from Evernote.
Oh, I love Phil. One of the awesome. Best CEOs out there. A really great guy.
Very
thanks.
Good friend of ours.
Yeah, isn't he? He's great. And Evernote is an amazing product. Thanks for joining us. This Week in Radio Tech is coming up next. We'll see you next time. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Leo.
On Triangulation.